from the high desert in the great American Southwest.
I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever it may be, wherever you are across this great land of ours. From Guam in the west, known as the Rock, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands. More rocks. South into South America, north, all the way to the pole and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. Good morning. In a moment, you are going to hear, for the first time, no, actually for the second time, about a man who told a tale, or at least he says he told a tale, to us last night about what happened in Germany. You may recall toward the end of the interview, if you made it that far last night, that I requested permission from him to hand his number out to a number of investigators, including Linda Moulton Howe. And I did. And she called him. And when she got him, he collapsed like a house of cards and said it's all a lie. And this is one of the more interesting stories you're going to hear. So we're going to update that, something that really did happen in Germany. And we're going to update the story in the Antarctic, which is really, really, really getting interesting. All of that directly ahead. All right, investigator. We'll put that tonight at the top of the list. Into crop circles, animal mutilations, all sorts of various stories that we hear here. Author. Producer of environmental documentaries, somebody who's just been with us for years and years on the program, Linda Moulton Howe. And we meet again so soon. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Art.
Hi there. Well,
when I heard your interview last night with that man calling himself Deke Richards,
right,
his voice reminded me of the infamous Kent 3 or 4 years ago who said that he worked for JPL and had information about Mars photographs.
Right.
And then when several of us tried to confirm his employment at JPL, we could not, and he admitted then that it was a hoax.
He did, and he admitted it on the strength, if you'll recall, supposedly of a reverse speech thingy. And he said, oh, you got me. And then he admitted during his confession that he was a disinformation agent for the government. That's what he said as part of his confession then.
Right. Now, something similar happened today in trying to verify Richard's statement last night that he worked for the Interior Department in the state of Maine. First of all, there is no Interior Department in the state of Maine. There are a few interior field offices, but I ran his name through a check both in several offices in the state of Maine today related to forestry and fish and wildlife, and I went to the Department of Interior and had the name checked for all of the employees in the Department of Interior, and it didn't check out.
No Deke Richards.
No, and after you gave me his cell phone number, I called him this afternoon, told him that his name did not check out, and here are some very brief excerpts recorded with his permission, and he agreed to allow me, after this discussion on tape this afternoon, to play this during the Coast Report tonight.
All right. Here we go.
I'm going to just ask you very straightforwardly something that was in the back of my mind last night and today. Are you the Kent from 3 or 4 years ago who called Art and me as being an employee of JPL?
Straight answer?
Yes.
Yes.
So the whole thing is a ruse?
Yeah, the whole thing's a ruse.
So why would you do it again?
Just to see if I could do it again. To all them Coast to Coast listeners out there, I'm sorry. I know sorry doesn't cut the mustard. And anybody that was in the 29th with me and everything else, I'm sorry for putting everybody on the spot like that.
So you're claiming to have done some military service.
I did do some military service that I am very proud of for 6 years. I was in the Army. I was in bomb holder with the 29th. I was there for 2.5 years. I re-enlisted, and I made an inter-theater transfer to the 66th Transportation Company in Kaiserslautern.
But you do not, or there is not a single thing that you said about this crash and retrieval operation
about
that is
the,
true.
No.
It's all made up. It's all
yeah,
made
it was,
up.
It was all made up. It was an Air Force jet aircraft that did crash. Yes, it was. And that was what I got this from.
Even though this man seems to be a chronic liar or calculated misinformer, Art, over the years there have been serious military and civilian eyewitnesses who have reported many strange aircraft over Germany, even some at Fulda Gap.
Yes, but before we proceed, Linda, there is one other aspect of this story that bears investigation, doesn't it? That we're not going to discuss on the air. We've agreed
right.
not to discuss
That's right.
who's involved. But there is another serious aspect to this whole Fulda Gap thing
yes.
in Germany, and we're going to follow up on that.
Yes, and probably several things happened at Fulda Gap, and we will do more investigation. And one of those incidents allegedly occurred 15 years ago, right after the April 26, 1986, nuclear power reactor meltdown at Chernobyl, Russia. The eyewitness there was Sergio Arellano, born in El Paso, Texas, 50 years ago, graduated from high school there, and then joined the U.S. Army, where he earned a degree in transportation. By the end of April 1986, so we're talking about the 15th anniversary as of today of Chernobyl, so we're 15 years almost to the day. After that awful nuclear meltdown, Sergio was a master sergeant in Mannheim, Germany, working in the 28th Transportation Battalion. In 1996, he retired from the Army and returned to his hometown to work for a commercial trucking company. Sergio remembers how the Mannheim base was put on restrictions to lessen exposure to dangerous radioactivity spreading over Europe. And he particularly remembers one of those early mornings around 7 a.m. when he had reported for duty. He was at the truck master's dispatch office in the motor pool that overlooked downtown Mannheim. The sun was shining and the sky was blue. Some 30 soldiers were outside the office waiting for their orders from Sergio, and half a dozen of his colleagues were inside the office. Suddenly, people began yelling and pointing at the sky. He drew what he remembers, and Coast listeners can see Sergio's unusual drawing now while he talks about this at my website, www.earthfiles.com, in the Real X-Files section. The drawing is very interesting. And now, here is Sergio Arellano describing what flew over American troops in Mannheim, Germany, in late April 1986, soon after the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown.
Germany again.
Well, what we saw was a big old ship of some type, aircraft. Well, it really didn't resemble an aircraft. It looked like one of those old German helmets. It had the shape of a German helmet, or a Kevlar, modern army helmet, and it was flying pretty low, maybe between 5,000 and 6,000 feet, and it was going maybe at 100 knots, based on the fact that we parachute a lot, and that's about the height that a helicopter flies when we parachute out of it, and it was going not too fast, and the colors were sort of yellow. It had some green on it, dull green, blue, and it looked like a liquid and a solid kind of material at the same time. And it didn't seem solid. It looked more like liquid, like mercury, like when you grab a piece of mercury and you move it in your hand and you stab it with little things, and you know, it just looked liquidy and solid at the same time. It had a streamer on the back that it would get bigger and it would get smaller, but it had a constant streamer.
Did it have a color?
It was the same color as the object, which was the same color. It was no different color.
Did it make any kind of sound?
No sound, no nothing.
How big do you think this was?
Well, based on what we all decided that it was about the average size of one of our barracks. Our barracks were five stories high, and maybe about a couple of hundred feet long.
So this is pretty big.
It was a big thing, and the sun was hitting it. I mean, we had a clear view, and besides us, at the battalion
a parade field, the battalion was having a formation, so practically maybe 90% of the battalion was present.
How many people would that be?
That would be maybe 1,500 men and women.
So if you add those 1,500 and about 100 of you up where you were, you're getting up to about 1,600 people in that one area that would have had a chance to see this object.
Oh, yes, because immediately after that formation and when everybody got it together, that was a topic of conversation in the dining facility and everywhere else. I mean, we all saw it.
Well, what did your superiors say that they thought that this object that was shaped like a military helmet that seemed to be both liquid and solid with these odd colors of greens and so forth, five stories high, a couple hundred feet long. What did they say it was?
Well, nobody seemed to know. Now, everybody was saying that it was a UFO based on the fact that nobody knew what it was. And, it was just shocking that it would fly right over our military area. In our military area, in Germany there, we have five or six big barracks, which is one of the largest concentration of soldiers in Germany, and some of it is a no-fly area. And we contacted the intelligence section of our battalion to let them know that, report that craft flying over us to see if it was anything that anybody knew what it was, or because it wasn't supposed to be flying on top of us.
And what was their response?
By 6 o'clock that evening, the official report was that there was no such craft, and that it was space debris that had come down and fell on Earth.
Are you saying that by evening, from the morning, that the official explanation from the military was that this was some kind of space debris?
That's exactly what they reported it. They also reported on the Stars and Stripes the following day. By noon, they had reported that it was a UFO, and it had came in from the Netherlands, I guess towards Germany, and that it had been sent interceptors from the Netherlands. Now we sit between two air bases, one in Frankfurt and one in Kaiserslautern. And both are like the biggest air bases in Europe, Ramstein and Rhein-Main. So it was shocking to us that we didn't see no aircrafts chasing it. It took a long time. We observed it for maybe 10, 15 minutes. It took a long time to pass over us and just go right over Mannheim, and it continued on going.
And something that was that big that would take 10 to 15 minutes that you would all watch, 1,600 of you, that's not space debris, is it?
No, because space debris, we as military personnel, they have seen a lot of, shooting stars and meteorites that travel, because most of our training is at night.
And that's all fast.
Sure, you see a lot of it, and sometimes you see some in the early dawn. But no, those things are fast. They got a lot of light. This was dull in color, and as it was going over us, there was three little, I say white lights of some type, but they weren't like bright lights. They were just dull white objects, and one or all three came from different directions, and they sort of merged into this thing and like went right into it without no doors opening or anything. Just like they came in and pooped right into it, and that was something that we all discussed and we all saw it, because when we saw those things coming at it, we said, what the heck was that? And it just went right in there.
Tell me more about those white objects.
Okay, they were, they looked like little baseballs. They were white. I wouldn't say they were glowing white lights. They were just white, very clean baseballs, and one came in from the east, and they all came in at more or less at the same time, and one came in from the southwest, and the other one came out of the north towards the south, and they all sort of merged into this thing. They like hit the thing and went right into it and became one with a big ship there.
And did they all seem to merge at the same place?
No, they hit it at different places. Mm-hmm. They came in at three separate angles or three separate directions, and they all went right into it, and I mean, they didn't slow down or nothing. Now, those were coming in at a pretty fast rate of speed,
mm-hmm.
and they went right into it, and we all saw it, and that's because we said, at first we thought, maybe somebody's shooting at this thing, you know, because of the military bases.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, it looks like somebody shot at this thing, but then we realized that, no, it was no shots. It was, these things came in and went right into it, and the craft didn't stop. It didn't slow down. It just, you know, like swallowed the things up and continued on going.
Did any of your superior officers talk with any of you privately off the record about having any other knowledge about what these unidentified or this unidentified craft might be, and was the term extraterrestrial ever used?
Well, we were all sure that, because the commander also witnessed it, was sure that it was something we had never seen, and it was a craft of some type, or an object of some type that was being self-propelled. No, nobody ever asked about it, nobody ever mentioned it, and the word was that that was that, and that was the end of the story.
Meaning that it was just, quote-unquote, space debris.
Yes, that it was space debris, and that that's the end of the story, and after that, nobody really mentioned it, because, you know, being in the military, if you keep on harping on something, then, you know, all of a sudden, doors start closing on you.
So you knew, all of you, and that's a lot of guys, that was at least 1,500 right there at Mannheim, that this was some kind of a cover-up, right?
Well, we knew exactly that was it, and we talked about it all that night, because everybody sort of hangs around. There's only one bowling alley, one NCO club there, one PX, one commissary. So, you know, everybody was talking about it and, you know, how silly that was by saying that it was space debris, when in fact we all saw it.
Sergio Arellano hopes that someone else stationed at Mannheim, Germany in the spring of 1986 will hear this broadcast. Look at his drawing at earthfiles.com in the Real X-Files section and come forward to add their recollections of this very strange helmet-shaped craft and those white, whatever they were, lights that went in and out. And if so, please contact me, Linda Howe, H-O-W-E, at my email, earthfiles@earthfiles.com, or fax 215-491-9842. Again, earthfiles@earthfiles.com or fax 215-491-9842. And Art, there may have been a couple of thousand people in Mannheim who saw it that day, but as he just explained, if the military stands in front of you and says you didn't see it, then that's what they live with for a long time. And Sergio said, I've been out for a long time, and he said, you live with these things, and I wanted you to know.
All right, Linda. Thanks for the investigative effort. Thank you for the story, and thanks for being here tonight. Stay
yes.
late.
More later.
All right, later. Indeed. That's Linda Moulton Howe, and oh, my. When you think about all of this, and we'll sort of chronicle it here in a moment for you, Kent tells second lie and caves in immediately, second time. First time, JPL, second time, and there's more to tell. There's a lot more to tell about this, and there's a lot to wonder about it. Is he really DIA? Is he really an official disinformation agent? Maybe. We're going to update Antarctica in a moment.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed, and we're going to sort through a little more of the infamous Zeke story slash Kent slash Now's Happened Twice story in a moment. And then we're going to update you on what's going on in the Antarctic. And that is such a big mystery. It's a gigantic mystery. And it's just getting thicker and thicker and thicker. Stay right there. Now, let us consider for a moment. We have the infamous Kent, who tells us this bogus story, supposedly, about JPL. I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. I'd have to, maybe Richard will remember how long ago it was. And then, when confronted, Kent immediately confesses, and I mean immediately, based on being found out, supposedly, by some reverse speech technique. Remember all that? Now, fast forward 3 or 4 years, however long it's been a long time. I sure didn't nail his voice. A lot of you did. And Linda did toward the end. Richard didn't in the beginning. He thinks he did toward the end. But fast forward the 3 or 4 years to last night, we got a story about Germany. He was in Germany. He was in the military. He was in the area. But at the end of the interview last night, what does he do? He tells us he works for the Interior Department, State of Maine. No such thing. So the moment he said that, he had to know he was had, because I was going to give his number out, ask his permission right at the very end of the interview. So add to that the fact that I've got about a half dozen emails now from people who claim they were here, they were there, and saw exactly the same thing. Didn't tell you about that. Add to that the fact that Linda and I both know about something that we can't quite discuss right now. Add to that the fact that the first time he confessed went down like a house of cards. He admitted he was a DIA agent, which itself could be a complete lie. Once a lie-er, always a lie-er, you could suggest and believe. But why both times would he tell a lie, a detailed lie like that, and then almost set it up, and in fact not almost, but set it up so that he would have to confess the following day? I think I'm going to keep a very close eye on the Fulda Gap region in Germany, and anyway, that's so I think that we're dealing with somebody here who intentionally, obviously intentionally, but I think for greater reasons, if you were going to try to point somebody's attention away from something, what better way to do it than what he did? What better way to do it? If you wanted to move attention away from something, what better way than to tell a story and then confess? Not once now, but twice. Here with an update on the Antarctic, which is every big as giant puzzle. It's getting worse. As a matter of fact, I just got an email from Lynn Samuels at WABC. I couldn't open it, but she indicated the email was from a London paper, which is reporting, she thinks, something about fight injuries. In other words, the people who came off the aircraft might have had fight injuries. So I don't know what's behind that. Maybe some of the rest of you can dredge it up and get it to me quickly in email. But it would be as much of a mystery as everything else that's happened with regard to this story. So here's Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, hi.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening. So Kent again.
Kent again. Well, you know, Mr. Disinformation, this is a pattern. When there's something going on, real, Kent pops up to try to lead us in the other direction. It's like what I used to call the Mockingbird Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Before I got into space and before I got into, you know, astrophysics and all that, I was interested in ornithology. So I know something about bird behavior. And mockingbirds and catbirds are two species that when something threatens the nest, the mother mockingbird or catbird will throw itself on the lawn. Let's say it's a cat, all right?
Right.
And flutter and pretend that it's got a broken wing, and oh, this poor thing is just, and it's always just out of reach of the cat. And when it gets the cat far enough away from the nest, suddenly the wing is back and it flies away, and the cat goes, "What? What happened?" And that's what Kent is. He's our mockingbird on the lawn.
Fluttering on the lawn, yeah. Very, very, very interesting. The way this came down was really interesting, and there's behind-the-scenes stuff that we can't talk about. Anyway, listen, on to the Antarctic.
Well, the Antarctic is, we left everyone last night. I mean, I feel like the perils of Pauline here. We had a ship, a container ship, loaded with 138 trucks of equipment.
Yes.
Truckloads full of equipment.
All right.
Pulling out of port of...
Wainimi.
Wainimi, yeah. I'm, those poor folks are going to really hate me. Actually, it's a fort, I found out today.
Well, right? It's also a port.
That's right. But it is a military debarkation point.
It's a fort port.
Yep. And... The container ship is headed for the Antarctic. Now, I have tried all day through various sources in the States to confirm this, and it's very, very difficult. Nobody seems to want to talk. My first order of business is, if anybody's listening from Port Wahine, would you give Art a call or send an email or send a fax to Enterprise and let us know that this ship did depart at midnight last night Pacific time, which is literally when we were on the air.
Yeah, let's have your fax number.
The fax is 505.
505.
286.
286.
6130.
6130. Okay.
We had a lot of faxes today, but they were kind of all around the point. People who have other ideas, but...
I know, Richard. I've heard everything under the sun about this, except the truth.
Yes, yes. There are very few people on the inside who are telling us the truth yet.
Fight,
however,
sickness, radiation, take your choice, but...
Broken legs? Homesickness, don't forget that.
Oh, homesickness, that's right.
You know, and head injuries. Remember the firefighter interviewed by New Zealand television who had head injuries but appeared totally unmarked, unblemished,
yes,
and coherent?
Yes.
Everything under the sun.
Oh, Richard, by the way, I have, you're going to love this. Hey, Art, Tom from Lakewood, Colorado, Denver. I just watched on Fox 13 News, the doctor walked away when the plane landed in Chile. He said... He felt okay, said he had a great flight. Strange, very strange.
I watched this live on CNN this afternoon through video phone. They had it from Punta Arenas, which is the little point in Chile where the airplanes touched down when they left the British base of Rothera on the continent.
Yes, this is the guy they've got to evacuate
for. The plane lands. I mean, this has been an arduous, back-breaking, humongous, historic, never done before.
Life-threatening.
Yeah, I mean, everything you can imagine. The world is focused on this guy. He gets out of the plane. He's got a shoulder bag on. He's got a cap on. He's walking, sauntering along. He meets with some Raytheon guys. Then my old friend Gary Tuckman, who works for CNN,
yes,
comes up to him, sticks a mic in his face, and says, "Doctor, how do you feel?"
Uh-huh.
"Fine." "Well, what are your plans?" "Well, because they've done this whole big build-up, you know, between Atlanta and Chile."
Yes.
"That the doctor's going to get on, you know, he's going to rest, and he's going to get on a commercial flight and go to the hospital and have this terrible thing taken care of." And Tuckman says, "What are you going to do?" He says, "I don't know, got no plans." And then the guy says, but how do you feel? You've just come from Antarctica." He says, "I don't really want to talk about it now." And he walked away. He blows Gary Tuckman off. He doesn't use the opportunity on global television to thank the people, all the hundreds, if not thousands of people who contributed their part to making his rescue in the middle of the Arctic night successful.
Well, there's a reason.
He risked life and limb.
Yeah, I've got a source down at the Antarctic, or a source of a source, who says he didn't want to go. They had to drag his butt out of there.
Yep.
And he was saying he was fine and he was going to stay, and yet they dragged his butt out of there. And, Richard, mainstream TV is covering all this story, maybe until they got embarrassed down there, as you just pointed out, and has ignored the bigger story of, what, 11 people coming down?
11 people.
A couple in critical condition.
Missing patients in the hospital.
Missing patients. Now, there's a big story for you, and they're not touching it.
Sounds like a mockingbird to me.
Fluttering on the lawn.
On the lawn. Just keep that image, folks, in mind. The mockingbird fluttering away while the real story goes in the other direction.
That's real.
So when I saw him blow off Tuckman, you know, nobody can be that self-absorbed. Nobody can be that selfish not to realize even if for an instant, that he's on global TV, that he's got an opportunity to at least thank the guys that risked their lives.
Well, he was obviously, he was angry.
He was angry.
Yeah.
Now, why would this guy be angry if he's really suffering? I mean, this is a life-threatening disease. If he was there, the only doctor, for 5 months in the cold with 50 other people at Amundsen Scott Base, and he had another attack, he passed another stone, and it went into peritonitis or some other complication.
And he walks away.
He would die.
I mean, what I would expect from a life-threatening flight to risk bringing somebody out would be somebody who would get off the plane quickly, would be transported by a stretcher to an ambulance.
They said, Tuckman said, we thought he'd be met by an ambulance. He's walking.
Boy, is something ever wrong down
but
there.
But they don't get it. It's like these people are brain dead. They can never believe in the C word because to them, the world is the way they report it. The world is the way they're... I mean, we are losing so much in terms of deep investigative reporting, which is why I'm very glad tonight to report that a story that we were going to possibly talk about tonight, we don't have to report. Our deep undercover investigative sources in New Zealand are hard at work, have now enlisted additional sources that are officially connected, and in the next day or two, we may know some really interesting specifics on the 11 who came to Christchurch and the two who disappeared in the hospital, and the rest of that story.
This is too much.
Now, let me go back to the container ship, because this, I think, is a major piece of news, and I would like to challenge any mainstream reporters to do what they're paid to do and dig into this story. Last night at midnight, Pacific time, a container ship left with truckloads upon truckloads of gear headed for McMurdo, and it will arrive when it can't get into McMurdo. For those of you who don't know the geography of the South Pole, McMurdo sits at the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf.
Mm-hmm.
It's called an ice shelf for a reason, everybody, because in the winter it freezes solid through that entire bay. So if you have a container ship blithely steaming south from California, by the time in the next 2 weeks it gets there, it ain't going to get in. So what are they going to have to do? They're going to have
break
an icebreaker from New Zealand break a path into McMurdo with 138 truckloads of huge crates filled with what? To do what? Well, one big problem today was confirming that any of this happened. Tonight, I am pleased to report that a gentleman named Duncan Rhodes, who is an editor of a magazine well known to many of your listeners, Art, it's called Nexus. It's published in Australia.
Oh, yes, Nexus.
It turns out that Duncan has been on the case with us and through independent sources has confirmed that this ship did, in fact, leave last night from Point Lahaina and is headed south to the Antarctic continent.
Waimimi.
Waimimi, I'm sorry.
You have a problem with that word.
I have that problem with that word, yes. Anyway, the point is that something big is going down. You don't do this when winter is coming on. Winter is a time down in the South Pole when you kind of hunker down. You don't go out and count penguins. You don't do any of the other stuff. You basically just watch your instruments and wait for spring to come.
Yeah, by the way, when they did this first rescue, it was the chill was 144 below zero.
That was the wind chill, yes.
That's right. So this really was life-threatening to get all of this done
on both occasions. One gracious word about all these people who really risked their lives. You know, there was a nurse on the plane, apparently. There was a doctor brought in, Betty Carlisle, who substituted for him. She was from McMurdo. And he just walks away and says to Tuckman, I'll talk about this later. Bizarre. Now, this feeds, however, into another major breakthrough we had today, which is we now have a confirmed on-the-record source that something has been going on in Antarctica that you and I did not know about, that we apparently have been paying for years, which is part of our scenario.
What?
In the last couple, 3 days, we've been exchanging emails quietly with a gentleman named Frank D. Carsey, a name you will not know, but you will know momentarily. Frank Carsey is the director of the JPL Vostok/Europa drilling project. And he opened Hailing Frequencies with a very nice email a few days ago pointing out that I had made a mistake in one of our graphics on the What's Up at the South Pole post that we put on the Enterprise site a couple days ago.
Right, right.
As we progress through our conversations, we have been asking him some very pointed questions. And tonight we got permission to quote, both in our official postings as well as on the air, the following information. You know that we had in our article a so-called press release by one Deborah Schingteller, who was supposed to be a JPL employee who announced that their project was canceled because the NSA had taken over the project.
I recall.
Okay. According to Mr. Carsey, actually Dr. Carsey, he has asked around, and no one at JPL has heard of Deborah Shingteller. She is not in the official phone book. She is not listed in the NASA X-500 file of staff, and it appears to be another elegant piece of disinformation. He also has completely and categorically denied that the NSA is behind any of their work, and I must say I believe him. And the reason I believe him is because of the following part of his statement. He says, I know of no NSA work in Antarctica and no interest on their part in ice drilling. But then he goes on to say, in fact, since the fall of the evil empire, that part of the government, and especially their funding, is a greatly missed and lamented player in the polar regions.
Well, but that's saying...
You understand what he's saying?
Yeah, of course, he's saying they were there.
Exactly. This is an official confirmation that the National Security Agency, in years past, has been a major source of funding and now a lamented lacking player in the polar regions. What the heck was the NSA doing at the South Pole?
I don't know.
Now, this is important because I have been saying for a long time, folks, that most of NASA is honest. Most of JPL is honest. I want to give a gold star to a patriot tonight. I want to single out Dr. Carsey as a good guy for telling us as forthrightly as one could possibly tell us that, in fact, the NSA has been there. Now, let me tell you how I interpret this. That they have been there in the past. He does not know for a fact that they're now. But I would suspect that he is wondering, as we've all wondered, why their project, their incredibly important, interesting project to safely drill through the ice on Vostok as a preparation for the Europa phase,
yes,
has been cut off at the knees. In fact, he says, what has me a bit concerned is the indifference of Washington, D.C., not just NASA, by any means, to our project.
The drilling project.
The drilling, which means, I take it from his line, other agencies, the political committees that were formerly behind him.
Yes.
It's all suddenly changed. Now, why would it change? Maybe because his project is now superfluous, and he's not in the loop. He doesn't know why they've been cut off at the knees, but he is honestly telling us that he knows that they were there before.
Yeah, all right, but why shouldn't I presume then, like a lot of the audience, that if he's telling us officially they were there before, then who's to say they're not there now? He says they're not there now, or he doesn't have knowledge of their being there now, but they don't always tell you when they're there.
Well, of course not, and I think he's being very precise so that he's telling us the truth the way he sees it.
Why would he want us to know the NSA was there?
Because maybe he suspects they're there now, and that's the reason. Now, that's my suspicion. That's not what he said. I want to keep it very clear
right. Between
what we're inferring and what he is saying. But the fact that he has given us permission to quote this, to print this, to
use
put it out
name,
there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he is the first high level, I mean, this is not he's not Kent. You know, we've got his JPL email address. He is the director of this project.
Yeah, so you know for sure who he is.
We know absolutely that Frank Carsey is in communication with us, and he has been very friendly and collegial, which is another surprising thing. I mean, you know, the JPL wisdom on us is not exactly, you know, they burn me in effigy in the halls at midnight.
I know.
So for him to be as open and candid and as forthright, and to absolutely tell us on the record that they've been there in years past, is an extraordinary step forward. Because remember what I reported also last night, that my source in New Zealand claimed from her U.S. intelligence that there were four guys smuggled in this airplane when they went to get the doctor
yep. With
gear and all that, yep. And they came from Nova Scotia. Well, we think that's a cover story. We think that's disinformation. We think
right. That's
falarmy.
Richard, we got to end it here. As Matt Drudge would say, developing.
And then some.
And then some. Thanks, Richard.
Stay tuned.
Yep, good night. Oh, brother. It's deeper than the ice up there. No, wait a minute. That's down there, right? James Von Prague is next.